Her friends called her beloved and irreplaceable. Co-workers said of the death of 35-year-old Christina Yuna Lee, "Our hearts are broken. Another senseless and horrific crime in our city. Another Asian American victim, leaving that community reeling."
I mean, what we're hearing and what we're seeing, right? This is not an isolated incident. We're seeing over and over again that there is a rise in violence towards Asian Americans. Whether we classify it as a hate crime or not, we cannot erase the fact that two-thirds of the attacks have been towards Asian American women.
Christina Yuna Lee was brutally murdered in her sixth-floor walk-up apartment on Christie Street in Chinatown. A homeless man who followed her into the building early that morning was arrested and charged with stabbing her 40 times. A month earlier, Michelle Goh was murdered by another homeless man who pushed her in front of a moving subway in the Times Square station. This week on 880 In Depth, violent attacks against Asian Americans are on the rise, just part of an overall rise in hate crime in our city. What is at play, and what is being done to stop it?
One thing that we have to look at is historically that people tend to commit crimes in a lot of different circumstances. One of them being like when people are frustrated, when people are bored, when people have a lot of other stressors going on in their life and they take it out onto others.
Welcome to 880 In Depth. I'm Steve Scott. You can hear the pain in the voices of community leaders like Terrence Park, head of the Asian American Voters Alliance.
We want protection! We want safety! We want it now!
Park, just one of the leaders at a rally against Asian hate crime days after Christina Yuna Lee's murder. Julie Wan is a New York City Council member who represents communities in Western Queens. Our Peter Haskell spoke to her this week about the rise in crime.
I mean, what we're hearing and what we're seeing, right? This is not an isolated incident. We're seeing over and over again that there is a rise in violence towards Asian Americans. Whether we classify it as a hate crime or not, we cannot erase the fact that two-thirds of the attacks have been towards Asian American women. So we can't erase the gender violence of this. Nor could we erase the ethnicity or the race of the individuals that are being slaughtered or harassed or assaulted in any way.
What's going on? Why do you think this is happening?
Well, it's multiple layers, right? We saw an increase in racism towards Asian Americans during the pandemic, especially when we had leadership in the government who were calling this the Kung Flu, the Chinese virus, which continued to inflame the economic difficulties that everyone was facing. And then we have the influx of homelessness, as well as mental illness, substance abuse, and it's kind of the perfect storm where we're seeing violence erupt in our city in all different ways, and they tend to be targeting the most vulnerable, which are Asian women and Asian seniors in our city.
What should the city do? What should the police department be doing?
So when we were standing here the other day with the original press conference the morning of the murder, we heard from the borough president that within the last 10 years, we actually saw we saw mental hospices be shut down instead of being opened or being increased in funding. Because what we're seeing over and over again in the patterns of the perpetrator is that they have a pattern of being homeless. They also have patterns of mental illness, like proven mental illnesses, as well as substance abuse that have not been treated in the way that would help them get better. And they are in our streets, and it's a very complicated issue, but we need to make sure that we're having real investments in long-term solutions, because it's just not realistic for us to think that as an Asian American woman who's living in fear that I'm going to have a personal bodyguard or a police officer with me at all times. It's not sensible and it's not realistic. And that's not going to keep me safe. But what we can do is make sure that we're foreseeing the avalanche to come. The eviction moratorium has ended. And now with the bottleneck in the courts, within the next 3 to 6 months, we're going to see from the housing courts, there's only going to be an influx of more homelessness and more substance abuse, as well as more mental illnesses in our streets and in our public safety will continue to be at risk.
City Councilmember Julie Wan. We also spent time this week with Kevin Nadal, distinguished professor at the City University of New York, where he teaches forensic psychology. Peter Haskell began the interview this way.
We have seen this spike in anti-Asian hate crime last year, continuing into this year. What's going on?
Yeah, you know, since 2020 and the start of the pandemic, there's been a lot of anti-Asian sentiment that was started in the media and especially by government leaders because of the coronavirus or COVID-19 originating in Wuhan, China. And so with that sentiment, it led to a lot of these various forms of violence that started to increase exponentially from 2020 to 2021. And we started to see, especially in 2021, acts of violence targeting specifically Asian American elderly folks, and especially in metropolitan areas. But starting in March 2021, there was started to become this attack on Asian American women. And we know about the six Asian women who were killed in Atlanta in these shooting sprees. And more recently, two Asian American women murdered in New York City in different consequences or context and with different consequences, different situations. But it's made a lot of Asian American people, especially Asian American women, really scared for their lives because of wondering if they're going to be the next one that will be targeted.
You talk about these different crimes in different places. Are there similarities between the perpetrators of these crimes?
You know, across the general, reports of looking at anti-Asian violence, it'll say that there are lots of different perpetrators of crime. Generally speaking, a lot of these instances involve white Americans, but some of these more high-profile cases are involving people with mental illness, many who happen to be Black or Black American. And so there's a intersectionality there, and some complicated issues to discuss as a result of that. So when these crimes are committed by white people, there's the idea of understanding white supremacy and systemic oppression. When these crimes are committed by people of color with mental illness, that we have to understand things like the impact of our mental health system, as well as some of these racial dynamics that are still a product of white supremacy, in which certain groups might, lash out onto other racial groups, and understanding how, this might be something that is still learned from these biases that are taught across all systems.
You know, it's interesting to talk about the attacks on Asian Americans, which we want to focus on, but in New York City, hate crime was up 100% last year across the board. So right. What are the intersecting factors? What are the differing factors that we've got it across the board, but specifically up more than 300% against Asian Americans?
Right. I'm glad you pointed that out, that hate crimes against people in general have increased in the past couple of years. And I think, one thing that we have to look at is historically that people tend to commit crimes in a lot of different circumstances, one of them being like when people are frustrated, when people are bored, when people have a lot of other stressors going on in their life and they take it out onto others. And so if we just remember that as a general trend that happens for people, and then intersecting that with the pandemic in which people were getting sick, people were losing family members and loved ones, people were losing their jobs or, not having enough money to pay rent and suffering from economic hardships, in addition to, maybe having these racial biases and so forth. And so people are committing crimes against each other, perhaps because they're frustrated, perhaps because they were bored, perhaps because they are lashing out on other groups who they deemed to be either vulnerable or disposable or some combination of those things and other things. And so when we we look at Asian Americans specifically, you know, we have to see that there was a correlation with the anti-Asian sentiment that started in early 2020 when the then president of the United States started to refer to this as the China virus or other racial slurs, that people started to, you know, resent Asian Americans and take it out on them. And, you know, this is something that we've seen historically, that this had happened in the 1800s and the 1900s when Asian people started migrating to the country in larger numbers. We saw this sentiment increase after 9/11 when government leaders and others were fixated on, you know, promoting these Islamophobic or anti-Muslim biases that then led to the increased hate crimes of Muslim people. So it's you know, a lot of ways in which we see the after effects of this people in power, systemic oppression, then, you know, trickling down into this interpersonal violence between two people, and again targeting folks who are often viewed as either vulnerable or disposable.
You know, I want to ask you about that in terms of this cultural perception, perhaps. Do you think Asian Americans are seen as easy targets? And do you think Asian Americans might be less likely to report crimes than other people?
Yeah, so to answer your questions, I mean, I think one of the things that is really prevalent, or at least you know, observable, is that, you know, there are certain types of Asian people that are being targeted. They're not targeting, you know, these 6 feet tall Asian American men who maybe they view as you know, being stronger, able to defend themselves. They're targeting elderly people who are oftentimes, you know, walking more slowly or using canes and walkers. And then they're targeting these women. Again, you know, women who might be smaller in frame and who they feel can, you know, target or victimize more easily. And so I think in general, there's this notion that that they can have some control over them and that they can, you know, blame them for their problems. And, you know, the second question about whether or not Asian Americans report crime, there has been plenty of research over the past 30 years that has demonstrated that Asian Americans tend to seek help the least amongst all racial groups, and that can include help with when they're targeted or victimized by crime. It also includes help when it comes to things like mental health services, that they tend to internalize, you know, problems, issues, even situations, and not you know, seek proper help when needed, which, you know, might also mean that even though there has been this 300% increase in crimes against Asian American, perhaps it's even more because they're just not being reported.
What should cops do about this? Two things. I mean, one, can you prevent this kind of thing? And assuming you can't, how do you police it? How do you deal with this?
You know, I have a lot of complicated views of police officers, especially someone who had worked as a consultant and trainer for the police for 8 years. But I think, you know, in your question, you know, you already posed a big part of it, is that a big part of the answer, which is that they really can't do a lot to prevent this from happening, right? Police usually show up after the crime had already happened. Having increased police in the subways did not prevent Michelle Goh from being pushed into the subway tracks, right? Maybe they were there to respond to the incident, but they weren't there. They weren't able to prevent that from happening. So I think that one of the things that is really important to really emphasize and reemphasize is that increased police presence is not going to prevent these crimes from occurring. I think that when police are involved, if there can be something they can do, is that they can be more helpful in reporting these crimes, being more able to provide, you know, these culturally competent, linguistically competent services when people want to report crimes, because oftentimes that's a big barrier for non-English speaking people who are targeted, or people where English is their second language. But the police in general, you know, aren't going to prevent these things from happening. Instead, what I am, along with a lot of other community leaders and scholars, are really big proponents of is putting money into the communities themselves, helping or letting communities decide how they want to spend their monies that might help prevent some of these things from happening. As an example, funding Asian American organizations who can create things like escort programs so that people can be escorted while they go shopping, especially elderly folks, or that they can have somebody do their shopping for them. Services that might be able to allow Asian American people, especially women, LGBTQ folks, if they don't feel safe, can somebody escort them in going home? You know, another thing that might help in the long run, but certainly might not see the effect in the short term, is just increased education about Asian Americans. A lot of people were very unaware and uneducated about the history of Asian Americans in the United States. When this increase in hate crimes occurred in 2020 and 2021, most people have not been aware of the increase or the hate crimes that occurred in the 1800s, late 1800s, early 1900s, nor even about, you know, the hate crimes after 9/11. And so, you know, I think having Asian American educational programs, having people be really able to learn about how their biases impact others, can be something that we teach kids in school from an early age, so that, you know, when they do become older, that they can, you know, learn how to manage those biases, understand that those biases are all part of this greater systemic oppression, and maybe that can help in preventing some of the crime. And then just as a last piece, I mean, I think one thing that's important to acknowledge, but also not, you know, to view as the main problem of this, is that there could be some mental health components from the perpetrators of these events. And I say that because, you know, I don't want to say that people with mental illness commit hate crimes, because they don't. Majority of people with mental illness and even severe mental illness are nonviolent, no more violent than the population of folks who do not suffer from mental illness. However, for those who do have mental illness and who do commit crimes, what types of services were provided for them that might have caught some of these violent tendencies earlier on, right? We're still learning more about the Michelle Go case and the Christina Yuna Lee case. But it appears that, you know, some of these perpetrators had been in and out of mental health facilities, you know, were suffering from schizophrenia. Where were the systems in that? How might them getting proper services have prevented any of these things from happening? So I think that's also something that's really important for us to attempt to digest, because, you know, having done, like I mentioned, I worked with NYPD for 8 years doing mental health training on how to work with people with schizophrenia. One of the things that that we know is that people with schizophrenia, even if police try to help them or if they go to, you know, the hospitals, they're usually in and out, and they're not really getting the proper services that they need. And so as a result of that, you know, we're just maintaining the status quo. And now we see that status quo includes the victimization and the targeting of violence towards Asian American people.
How do we change that? And two critical pieces, do we have the funding and do we have the wherewithal to try to change things? It seems like this is a tall order.
It is a tall order, but it's possible. There just has to be some rearranging of figuring out what is deemed more valuable versus what is not deemed valuable. You know, we spend so much money on certain aspects of policing that can be reallocated towards something else. For example, there have been plenty of programs that have emerged in the past even 5 years of a certain jurisdiction where when people suffer from mental illness, the cops aren't called. Instead, they call these mental health mental health responders who are able to show up to situations, de-escalate the situation, provide that person with resources they need. They even have their own vans or ambulances who can take them to institutions where they might be able to get services. The amount of money that is spent on police who are not trained as mental health practitioners to show up in those instances, oftentimes leading to unnecessary violence or unnecessary trauma to people involved. Maybe that money needs to be reallocated in certain ways. I look at just some of the ways that money is spent in general in our government, whether it be with the military or whether it be for programs that aren't shown to be effective. And then we have some of these programs that either are effective or that we won't know if they're effective because there's never been enough money to allocate to see if they're effective. And so it is a tall order, but I think that's where true leadership comes in to try to figure out if there's something else that's going to work because policing isn't the answer for a lot of things, in fact, maybe even most things, but that's where we keep throwing our money towards when, in fact, they might not be the most effective, nor the most trained or proficient in being able to handle certain situations.
Kevin Nadal has strong feelings about the role of police in helping stem the rise in hate crime and specifically crimes against Asian Americans in New York. But he also has deep concerns.
Speaking of police, the head of the NYPD's Hate Crimes Task Force has been reassigned. The city claims it's part of a normal change, but there have been reports that the person in charge was insensitive to put it perhaps charitably, in dealing with victims. And so I'm curious, what concerns, if any, does that raise for you? And how do you think the NYPD is doing with hate crime?
That's a great question. Like I said, I'd worked with them for many years before I decided that I could no longer work with them as an organization. I think this is one example of just how these programs might not necessarily be effective and how people who lead these programs might not be properly trained or even qualified to lead these programs. If you think about it, right, having a hate crimes task force generally could be a positive thing, but who's going to lead that? Do they have leaders in their department who have been trained in mental health awareness, have been trained in critical race theory, which I know is a really hot topic right now that people don't want to know about, but perhaps that person has a knowledge of the history of Asian Americans here in the United States. Perhaps that person has some ability to speak with people in interpersonal ways in which they can make victims or survivors feel safe, feel validated, feel like they can turn to police officers. One of the things that I've studied in the past is this idea of trust in the system. Sometimes we call this procedural justice, this idea of whether or not the criminal justice system is fair, equitable, and serving of your communities. And for so many historically marginalized communities, whether it's racial communities, Black people, Latino people, Latinx people, Asian American people, or even LGBTQ communities, or even women, that they might not feel safe reporting because the people in the department might not be sensitive to them, might not even be able to validate their concerns or listen to them. And in some cases, what some of my research and other people's research has found, even re-traumatize them. So imagine being a person who was victimized or targeted by a crime and then going to try to report it, and then the police officer there or the person at the desk commits a microaggression towards you or makes you feel like it was your fault in some way. That's not effective if that's what police are meant to be, is serving the people. And so, you know, having the programs isn't going to be helpful if the people running the programs aren't even qualified or if there isn't that proper training. And then the second part of your question is, how do I think the NYPD is doing? I think they're doing what they're supposed to be doing, you know, and that is that these systems were created to maintain the status quo. You know, I think, you know, police, and I say this, you know, not trying to be too controversial, but I say this because I do think there are police officers who are doing their job and, you know, trying their best. But I also know that the system is set up that there are so many people that are in the police force who don't care and who don't have to care because the system is set up where you know, people of historically marginalized groups are oftentimes unheard, unvalued, you know, people just might not actually see what the actual issues are, and if people are comfortable with that. And you know, unrelated, we know about the problems of police, which is the increase of police violence, the how their biases might affect things like the astronomical numbers of Black people killed by the police who are unarmed and most of the time have not committed any crime. And so, you know, there's so many problems with police. And I think this is why we really have to reevaluate the system, if not dismantle the system, so that people can really figure out what is actually working and what is actually serving these communities who have historically been underserved and, if not, overtly oppressed.
Dealing with a rise in hate crimes and a rise in crime on the New York City subway system has become a priority for new mayor Eric Adams.
Let me kick it off by introducing our mayor, Eric Adams.
The mayor, with the governor and the head of the MTA by his side, announced a program aimed at delivering needed social services to homeless and others who have sought refuge from the pandemic in the underground system. Increased public safety is something Mayor Adams believes needs to be a part of the city's recovery.
The subway system and our buses make New York what it is. And if they're not safe, if people don't feel safe, and if the numbers of crime are not reflective of who and what we want to be as a city, it's going to impact us. I say it over and over again, and in fact, many of you can finish the statement. But public safety and justice, they are the prerequisite to prosperity. I've said it for years, and I will continue not only to say it, but to make it happen. It must begin here in our subway system, and we are here to say it is going to start here. Subway riders are deeply concerned. We hear it all the time. I hear it every time I'm on the subway system. People tell me about their fear of using the system. And we're going to ensure that fear is not New York's reality.
As for ways to battle hate crime specifically, CUNY's Kevin Nadal believes the law itself could use an overhaul. For example, of the two most prominent cases of crimes against Asian women, Christina Yuna Lee and Michelle Goh, neither has been classified as a hate crime.
So that's the problem with hate crime law, is that it's so contingent on whether or not there is tangible evidence, and doesn't realize that for most people we have biases that, you know, are not spoken, are not written, and so it's not classifying you know, the crime as being a hate crime. But I do like your suggestion of looking at things as a whole, looking at a trend, looking at a pattern, and perhaps that might be something that people can see as being more motivated. But I don't know that would stand at the court of law because of, you know, different perpetrators, different situations, there will always be some other, like, explanation that people have, you know. And, you know, it's complicated, but this is where we are. And we, you know, I think if we really want to challenge hate crime law, we have to look at what is used to constitute whether or not a bias is, or a crime was biased. And one last thing I'll say about this, that, you know, I should have mentioned at the beginning, is that who gets to determine that whether or not it is biased? It's usually the police officers who start off at the investigation, and then it's the district attorney who has the sole decision of whether or not they're going to prosecute the case. And if those two entities, you know, say that there are no biases, then it's not considered a hate crime. But are those people even trained to understand what biases are? Are those people folks who have done training on understanding implicit bias, or have read the research or studied the research thoroughly on implicit bias and how it might affect our decision making? And then the last systemic thing is that a lot of police and a lot of the district attorney's offices out there, they don't want to prosecute these cases because it's a lot of work. So they feel overworked, they feel overwhelmed, and so sometimes they just want to just write off this case as being the bare minimum because that results in them having to do less. So there's also a systemic issue of, you know, whether these systems are even effective and if they're at capacity, and if so, who suffers? And so that's something that, you know, I just wanted to point out too.
Yeah, I mean, I think we'll wrap up on this. I mean, the point you made that you used the term tangible evidence, I mean, that's yep. the basis of the criminal justice system. You know, without proof of it yep. being a hate crime, you can't and maybe you shouldn't be able to charge as a hate crime. So is there a way to change the law? Do we need to change the law, or it's just complicated based on the circumstances?
Yeah, I mean, I think we can revisit the law to at least consider it as part of it. But, you know, what I'm saying also is, like, you know, for it to even get into for it to even be charged as a hate crime, you know, it means getting, you know, police officers, district attorney's offices, sometimes even medical examiners, to have that knowledge. And that's not even changing the law. That's just changing that system to be able to have some awareness of racial biases or, you know, other types of biases. And then once that happens, then it goes to the court. And then when it gets to court, you know, judges get to decide whether or not, you know, a charge is valid or reasonable or whatever it might be. And then, you know, so it might not even make it that far, right? So I think, you know, it's the existing processes that we have are so flawed that it's not even about changing the law right now. It's about changing every single step along the way for folks to really take into consideration, you know, what some of these other circumstances are. And then on top of that, if we find that isn't working, then, you know, the law can be officially changed. But it's like we can't even say that the law isn't working yet, because there's so many people who just aren't even doing that first part of their job in order to even see the effectiveness of these things.
Kevin, you've been so patient. This has really been an interesting conversation, and I thank you so much for your time.
I appreciate it. I appreciate talking about these things all the time, and thank you so much for giving voice to, you know, these Asian American women and others who just oftentimes their crimes get swept under the rug. So I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about some of these nuances today.
In Depth is our weekly deep dive into an important topic. The executive producers are Peter Haskell and Tim Schell. Subscribe so you don't miss a week, and listen on demand on your time. Just search for WCBS 880 In Depth wherever you get your audio. I'm Steve Scott. Thank you for listening.